It's a freezing morning again here in Northern California. I'm sitting here to read Vancouver out of Emily Carr, Growing Pains, the autobiography of Emily Carr. Everything was 5.5 years older than when I left home, but then so was I. 5 of the most impressionable years of life passed. I was glad some things had changed, sorry others had. I was sorry to say goodbye to my little self. I mean, the little self that is always learning things without knowing that it is doing so. It was nice now to go to church by choice and not be pushed there. It was nice even to miss occasionally without feeling helly. The YWCA was now firmly established in a fine new building of their own and did not have to pray all over our floors. My sisters belong to many religious and charitable societies. The choice was left to me. Ladies' Aid, YWCA, King's Daughters, 12 others. I joined none. There were no artists in Victoria. I do not remember if the Island Arts and Crafts Club had begun its adult existence. When it did, it was a very select band of elderly persons, very prehistoric in their ideas and art. It sort of reminds me of where I live, actually, but I think it's more contemporary now, but 20 years ago, there was not very many artists here, or at least there wasn't a group. Anyway, not San Francisco, I'm talking about my immediate area. Had to always drive to go find the artists. I digress, okay. It was nice to be home, but I was not there for long, because the Ladies Art Club of Vancouver asked me to accept the post of art teacher to their club. So I went to live in Vancouver. The Vancouver Art Club was a cluster of society women who intermittently packed themselves and their admirers into a small rented studio to drink tea and jabber art jargon. Once a week, I was to pose a model for them and criticize their work. I had been recommended by one of their members, who was an old Victorian and who had known me all my life. She was abroad when I accepted the post. The art club, knowing I was just back from several years of study in London, expected I would be smart and swagger a bit. When they saw an unimportant, rather shy girl, they were angry and snubbed me viciously, humiliating me in every possible way. Their president was a wealthy society woman. Floating into the studio an hour or more late for class, she would swagger across the room, ignoring me entirely, and change the model's pose. Then she would paint the background of her study an entirely different color to the one I had arranged. If I said anything, she replied, "I prefer it so." Other members of the class, following her lead and tossing their heads, would say with mock graciousness, "You may look at my work if you would like to, but I wish no criticism from you." Wow. Oh my God. At the end of my first month, they dismissed me. Perhaps I did look horribly young for the post. On her return to Vancouver, my sponsor sent for me. "I hear the Ladies' Club have dismissed you, my dear." "Yes, I am glad." All were unanimous in their complaint. "What was it?" Millie, she smiled. You tried to make them take their work seriously. Society ladies, serious? My dear, how could you?" She laughed. "They were vulgar, lazy old beasts," I spluttered. "I am glad they dismissed me, and I am proud of the reason. I hate their kind. I'd rather starve." "What shall you do now?" I've taken a studio in Granville Street. The only woman in the art club who was decent to me, an American, has sent her little daughter to me for lessons. The child has interested her schoolmates. Already I have a class of nice little girls. Good. With them, you'll be more successful. The club's former teacher was, quote-unquote, society. You understood, or she understood she understood the club ladies, complimented and erased simultaneously, substituting some prettiness of her own in the place of their daubs, something which they could exhibit. They liked that. She was older, too. The snubbing by the Vancouver Ladies' Art Club starched me. My pride stiffened, my energy crisped. I fetched my sheepdog and cage of bullfinches from Victoria, added a bunch of white rats, a bowl of goldfish, a cockatoo, and a parrot to my studio equipment, and fell into vigorous, hard, happy work, finding that I learned more during those frustrated years in England than I had supposed. Narrow, conservative, dull-seeing, perhaps rather mechanical, but nevertheless honest. Because I did not teach in the way I had been taught, parents were skeptical. But my young pupils were eager, enthusiastic. Every stroke was done from objects or direct from life casts. Live models, still life, animals. Young Vancouver had before been taught only from flat copy. I took my classes into the woods and along Vancouver's waterfront to sketch. A merry group we were, shepherded by a big dog, each pupil carrying a camp stool and an easel, someone carrying a basket from which the cockatoo, Sally, screeched. Sally is a Sally. That was Sally's entire vocabulary. If she was left in the studio when the class went sketching, she raised such a turmoil that the neighbors objected. Out with the class, joining in the fun, Sally was too happy even to shout that Sally was a Sally. We sat on beaches over which great docks and stations are now built. We clambered up and down wooded banks, solid now with Vancouver's commercial buildings. Stanley Park at that time was just 7 miles of virgin forest, three quarters surrounded by sea. Alone, I went there to sketch, loving its still solitudes. No living creature but Dog Billy and me, submerged beneath a drown of undergrowth. Above us were gigantic spreads of pines and cedar boughs, no bothersome public, no rubber noses. Occasional narrow trails wound through bracken and tough salal tangle. Underfoot, rotting logs lay, upholstered deep in moss, bracken, forest wastage. Your feet never knew how deep they would sink. I loved, too, the Indian Reserve at Kitsilano, and to the North Vancouver Indian Mission. Billy and I went for long days, our needs tucked into my sketch sack, and great content in our hearts. Vancouver was then only a little town, but it was growing hard. Almost every day you saw more of her forest being pushed back, half cleared, waiting to be drained and built upon. Mile upon mile of charred stumps and boggy skunk cabbage swamp, root holes filled with brown stagnant water, reflecting the blue sky by day, rasping with frog croaks by night, fireweed, rank of growth, springing from the dour soil to burst into lush, these are amazing words, how she puts these together, and a lot of them are hyphenated. Let me read this paragraph again. I didn't get to finish the paragraph. My eyes sometimes go over some words into the next word, and then, I have mistakes. So let me try this again. Vancouver was then only a little town, but it was growing hard. Almost every day, you saw more of her forest being pushed back, half cleared, waiting to be drained and built upon. Mile upon mile of charred stumps and boggy skunk cabbage swamp, root holes filled with brown stagnant water, reflecting blue sky by day, rasping with frog croaks by night, fireweed, rank of growth, springing from the dour soil to burst into loose-hung lush pink blossoms, dangling from red stalks, their clusters of loveliness, trying to hide the hideous transition from wild to tamed land. Quite a paragraph that was. The Foundationless Ladies Art Club of Social Vancouver was crumbling. Their president came to me asking that I give up my studio and share theirs, thereby lessening their rental. I refused. It's like, how are you kidding me? I'm sorry, I have to interject there. It's like, let me just shove her off into the over there, and then, oh, we need you to come and share this. God, the cost of the space. You know what? I've been through similar situations. Not quite like that, but my studio space out at Benicia. What a nightmare that was at the end. Some gal came in. One of the studio space partners I had died. Can't even remember his name right now. That's terrible. I think it's Tom. And the guy that was running it, or taking the rent for the people that were actually running it to him, he was subletting it to us. He had this girl come in, this gal come in that turned the front of the space into like this antique sales whatever, and then she sort of painted on the side. But I kept finding my materials. She would go into my space when I was not there, because I worked during the day and I had to paint at night. I'd come in at night and I'd find my materials in her spot where she was painting. It really started to irk me, and I left her a note or something, and I said, if you want to borrow something, you need to, you need to ask, basically. Well, anyway, she just dismissed it and never said a thing to me. But she had the front space, and then she decides to put a sign on the front of our space, excuse me, with her little antique store. Like the whole space is an antique store. Like, we didn't have our quote-unquote signs up, like Robin Milne Artist, Robin Milne Studio, or I can't remember the other guy's name right now, but I don't even think they were allowing us to do that on our outside of our spaces. Well, anyway, long story short, she just was like, she came in and just decided she was going to shift and change the whole thing. And I wasn't there during the day, and she was, so I was not able to really speak with her face to face. And one time, I guess, on the weekend, she came in, and she and I had it out a little bit, because she just, decides that she's, and then she's like writing love notes to the guy that's, collecting our rent. It was just disgusting. It was just disgusting. I think she's gone now, but, I ended up leaving that space, because it was just so unprofessional. And the next door to us, in came like a church group. So when I was there on the weekends, they were like singing really loud and having their church services while I was trying to paint. I couldn't even put my music on. I put my music on really loud so I could like not hear them, and I could still hear them. And it was just a nightmare. It was really a nightmare that last maybe 6 months I was there in that space. So, spaces, And then to have these people schmuck on her, and then she ask her back, sorry, I went off on a long tangent on that one, but I get this stuff, you know? Okay, let me go back to where she said. She says, I refused. Then she said, shall we give up ours and come to share yours? Oh my God. Sorry, I didn't even read that line. Shall we give up ours and come to share yours? Our teas, of course, but, smirked the lady, prestige of the Vancouver Ladies Art Club behind your classes. No, no, no. I don't want your prestige. I won't have the Ladies Art Club in my studio. Good for her. Gah. All right. The president tore down my stairs. I had not imagined presidents could rush with such violence. Wow. The first year that I lived and taught in Vancouver, my sister Alice and I took a pleasure trip up to Alaska. The Klondike rush had been over just a few years. We traveled on a Canadian boat as far as Skagway, end of sea travel for Klondike. Prospectors had left steamers here and gone the rest of the way on foot over a very rough trail. Those who could afford to took pack beasts. Those who could not packed their things on their own backs. The mushroom town of Skagway had sprung up almost overnight. It consisted of haphazard shanties spilled over half-cleared land. The settlement lay in a valley, so narrow it was little more than a ravine heading the shallow, muddy inlet. Three tipsy plank walks on crooked piles hobbled across the mud to meet water deep enough to dock steamboats. Each runway ended in a blob of wharf. Now, isn't that amazing? I love the way she does this. It's like, it's a visual way of writing. It's to me. Listen to that. Three tipsy plank walks on crooked piles hobbled across the mud to meet water deep enough to dock steamboats. Each runway ended in a blob of wharf. In a blob of wharf. I love it. Jumping gaps where planks had broken away, I went out onto the end of one wharf to look back at Skagway. Bits of my clothing and sketching equipment blew off into the sea. Wind always moaned and cried down the little valley, smacking this, overturning that shanty. The little town was strewn with collapsed buildings. Crying, crying, the valley was always crying. There was always rain or mist or moaning wind. It had seen such sadness, this valley. High hopes leveled like the jerry-built shanties, broken, crazed men drinking away their disappointments. A curious little two-coach train ran up the valley twice a week. Its destination was White Horse. It followed the old Klondike Trail. We took it up as far as the summit. Here, side by side, where their land met, fluttered two flags, British and American. The train jogged and bumped a good deal. We passed through valleys full of silence, mocking our noisy little train with echoes because our black smoke dirtied the wreaths of white mist which we met in the valleys. Wow. A stark, brooding, surly land was this, gripping deep its secrets, huddles of bones bleached by the wayside, bullock bones, goat and horse bones, beasts from whom the lure of gold did not exist, but who, broken under burdens of man's greed, had fallen by the way, while man, spurred on by the gold glitter, shouldered the burdens of the dead beasts and pushed further. In the valley, drowned under the lush growth, we stumbled upon little desolate log shanties, half-built. The finger of the wild now claimed the cabins, saying, mine, mine, mossing them, growing trees through the mud floors and broken roofs. How do these come to be here? I asked. Failures. Men who lacked the courage to go home beaten. Most drank themselves to death. For many, a gun was their last, perhaps their best, friend. No wonder the valley cried so. Of those who stayed in Skagway, it was seldom said, "He made good. He struck it lucky." The lucky ones went down to the cities, scarred by their Klondike experience, seldom happier for their added gold. We stayed 1 week in Skagway, then taking an American steamer across to Sitka on Baranof Island. Sitka had an American army barracks, a large Indian village, and an ancient Russian church. It also had many, many very large black ravens, sedate birds but comical. They scavenged the village, calling to one another back in the woods. The male and the female made different squawks. The cry of one was a throaty quaw. The other answered ping, sharp and strident as a twanged string. At the top of its flagpole, the barracks had a gilt ball, which had great attraction for the ravens. There was always three or four of them earnestly trying to get firm foothold on the rounded surface. It was amusing to watch them. As we walked through the little town of Sitka, I saw on a door, "Picture Exhibition. Walk in." We did so. The studio was that of an American artist who summered in Sitka and wintered in New York, where he sold his summer sketches, drab little scenes which might have been painted in any place in the world. He did occasionally stick in a totem pole, but only ornamentally, as a cook sticks a cherry on the top of a cake. The Indian totem pole is not easy to draw. Some of them are very high. They are elaborately carved, deep symbolical carving, as much or more attention paid to the attributes of the creature as to its form. The Indian used distortion, sometimes to fill spaces, but mostly for more powerful expressing than would have been possible. He had depicted actualities gaining strength, weight, power by accentuation. The totem figures represented supernatural as well as natural beings, mythological monsters, the human and animal figures, making strong talk, bragging of their real or imagined exploits. Totems were less valued for their workmanship than for their talk. The Indian's language was unwritten. His family's history was handed down by means of carvings and totemic emblems painted on his things. Some totems were personal. Some belonged to the whole clan. The American artist found me sketching in the Indian village at Sitka. He looked over my shoulder. I squirmed with embarrassment. He was twice my age and had vastly more experience. He said, "I wish I had painted that. It has the true Indian flavor." The American's praise astounded me, set me thinking. We passed many Indian villages on our way down the coast. The Indian people and their art touched me deeply. Perhaps that was what had given my sketch the Indian flavor. By the time I reached home, my mind was made up. I was going to picture totem poles in their own village settings, as a complete collection of them as I could. With this objective, I again went up north next summer and each successive summer during the time I taught in Vancouver. The best material lay off the beaten track. To reach the villages was difficult, in accommodation a serious problem. I slept in tents, in roadmakers' tool sheds, in missions, and in Indian houses. I traveled in anything that floated in water or crawled over land. I was always accompanied by my big sheepdog. Indian art broadened my seeing, loosened the formal tightness I had learned in England's schools. Its bigness and stark reality baffled my white man's understanding. I was as Canadian-born as the Indian, but behind me were old world heredity and ancestry, as well as Canadian environment. The New West called me, but my old world heredity, the flavor of my upbringing, pulled me back. I had been schooled to see outsides only, not struggled to pierce. The Indian caught first at the inner intensity of his subject, worked outward to the surfaces. His spiritual conception he buried deep in the wood he was about to carve. Then, chip, chip, his crude tools released the symbols that were to clothe his thought. No sham, no mannerism. The lean, neat Indian hands carved with what the Indian mind comprehended. Indian art taught me directness and quick, precise decisions. When paying $10 a day for hire of boat and guide, one cannot afford to dawdle and haver this vantage point against that. I learned a lot from the Indians, but who except Canada herself could help me comprehend her great woods and spaces? San Francisco had not. London had not. What about this new art Paris talked of? It claimed bigger, broader seeing. My Vancouver classes were doing well. I rode home, saving up to go to Paris. Everybody frowned. Hadn't London been a strong enough lesson? Must I try another great city? But I always took enough from my teachings, earnings, to go north and paint in the Indian villages, even while saving for Paris. One summer, on returning from a northern trip, I went first to Victoria to visit my sisters. There I received a curt, peremptory command. Hurry to the Empress Hotel. A lady from England wishes to see you on business connected with your Indian sketches. The woman was screwed up and frumpy, so stuffed with her own importance that she bulged and her stretched skin shone. I wish to see those Indian sketches of yours. For the moment, that is not possible. They are stored in my Vancouver studio, and it is rented, I replied. Then you must accompany me to Vancouver tonight and get them out. Do you wish to buy my sketches? Certainly not. I only want to borrow them for the purpose of illustrating my lectures entitled Indians and Artists of Canada's West Coast. Where do I come in? You? Publicity. I shall mention your work. Oxford. Cambridge. Her eyes rolled, her high-bridged nose stuck in the air. I might have been a lump of sugar. She the pup. Oxford and Cambridge signaled. Pup snapped. Oxford and Cambridge gulped. Me. I shall see you at the midnight boat then. You may share my stateroom. Magnanimously. Thanks, but I'm not going to Vancouver. What? You cannot be so poor-spirited. My work is patriotic. I am philanthropic. I advance civilization. I educate. You make nothing for yourself, exploiting our Indians. After expenses, perhaps just a trifle. You will not help the poor Indian by lending the Alert Bay sketches? My theme centers around Alert Bay. My interest woke. You have been there? Are you familiar with it? Oh, yes, yes. Our boat stopped there for 20 minutes. I walked through the village, saw houses, poles, people. And you dare talk and write about our coast Indians having only that much data? The tourist folders do better than that. Goodbye. Stop. She clutched my sleeve as I went out the hotel door. followed me down the steps, hatless, bellowed at me all the way home, spluttering like the kick-up waves behind a boat. She stalked into our drawing room, sat herself down. I said, "Excuse me, I'm going out." She handed me a card. "My London Club. It will always find me. Your better self will triumph." She smiled at, patted me. I said, "Listen, England is not interested in our West. I was in London a few years ago, hard up. A well-known author wrote a personal letter for me to a big London publisher. Take this to him with a dozen of your Indian sketches," she said, "and what a grand calendar they will make. England is interested in Canada just now." A small boy took my letter and returned, his nasty little nose held high, his h-less words insolent. "Leave your stuff. Boss'll look it over if he has time. I started down the stair. "Eh, where's your stuff? You hadn't left any. It is going home with me." At the bottom of the third flight, the boy caught up with me. "Boss says he'll see you now." The elegant creature spread my sketches over his desk. "America, eh? Well, take him there. Our British public want this." He opened a drawer crammed with pink-coated hunting scenes. "Indians belong to America. Take him there." "Canada happens to be British," I said, "and these are Canadian Indians." I put the sketches back in their wrappings. "Teach your English people geography, madam. Then maybe they will be interested in British things. Half the people over here don't know that all the other side of the Atlantic does not belong entirely to the Americans." And that is the end of Vancouver. So, next will be France. And we shall see what she does in France. It's another longer chapter, so I hope you enjoyed this. I don't know how well I read. I was sort of lost in it a bit myself, so all is well. I liked this chapter, though. It was great to hear about her walking and discovering all the different woods in her own land again. Take good care.